I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks from Radio Times. There's a lot of money sloshing around the campaign for president this year, but it's not a guarantee of a win. Take Jeb Bush, for example. He ended his bid for the White House after he and his supporters spent something like $150 million. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has been self-funding much of his campaign and getting a lot of free media. Many wealthy Republican donors have been sitting on their wallets on the sidelines. We asked Ken Vogel to join us. He tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp, on the trail of the ultra-rich hijacking American politics. And Ken Vogel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Marty.
So how does 2016 compare to 2012 in terms of money sloshing around the campaign for president?
Well, there's a lot more money coming into the primary process, and it's unclear whether it's having any effect whatsoever. You mentioned the $150 million raised by Jeb Bush and his super PAC allies to support his now-suspended campaign. Obviously, not a whole lot of return on investment there. And then on the flip side, you have Donald Trump, who has spent, so Bush, of that $150 million they brought in through the end of January, had spent about $125 million of it. Well, contrast that to Donald Trump, who through that time had spent $24 million, wow, and is having great return on the investment there, much of which, as you alluded to, is from his own pocket, but he's also raising some money from small donors, interestingly. On the other side of the aisle, you have Bernie Sanders. While he is spending money in sort of a traditional manner, which Trump, I should say, is not, Trump's campaign bears no resemblance to any kind of presidential campaign that we've seen win primary contests before it. It's based on free media, the types of media attention that he gets through his very splashy rallies and his controversial statements and his Twitter account. On the other side of the aisle, you have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton both running more traditional types of campaigns in terms of the spending, but Bernie Sanders is raising an overwhelming, historic amount of his money. He's raised $83 million, 70% of which has come from small donors, that is those who've given $200 or less. This is really turning on its head a lot of the thinking that we had come up with after the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010 on allowing unlimited spending. Everyone thought, well, big money is going to just forever alter the political landscape. In this primary, it has not.
And how does Bernie Sanders then compare to Barack Obama when he was using the internet and speaking to younger people to get them involved in the political system and getting them to donate to his campaign? Is that comparable, Ken?
In fact, Bernie Sanders is raising more of his money, a higher percentage of his money from small donors, and he has more small donors. So what we saw from Obama in 2008 was revolutionary in terms of engaging small donors through the internet to give small and continued donations that created sort of a sustainable revenue stream for a presidential campaign. And he talked at that time, and the people around him who were instrumental in sort of engineering this fundraising strategy talked about a small donor revolution, that this was going to change the way that campaigns are funded and really bring power back to the people and smaller donors. Well, fast forward 2 years after his 2008 election, and you had the Citizens United decision that I just mentioned, and there was some real concern even among the people closest to Obama that, hey, that small donor revolution has ended even before it started. And so in 2012, you saw Obama run a sort of more traditional fundraising operation where he raised more money from big donors, and he ultimately ended up endorsing a super PAC to go out and raise huge checks on his behalf to help fight off Mitt Romney and win re-election. And so at that point, I think we were all ready to write the obituary of the small donor revolution while Bernie Sanders and to some extent Donald Trump have kind of helped revive it.
Does that mean that the ultra-rich who hijacked American politics, part of your subtitle, that they really can't hijack at least the politics this year, or are they just sort of waiting to make their move?
Yeah, I think the verdict is still out, even if, you know, the sort of misconception has been that if you spend a ton of money in an election campaign and you don't win, it proves that big money doesn't influence politics. That's not true. I think that the money that has flowed into the process since 2010 on both the left and the right, but more the right, has really shaped the sort of acceptable parameters of debate and what it means to be a Republican. Now, again, Donald Trump is very much challenging that, but I think it will be interesting to see if, as appears increasingly likely, he wins the nomination. Will he sort of adhere more to the traditional Republican orthodoxy? Will the Republican National Committee, when it comes in to help him run a general, when and if it comes in to help him run a general election campaign, sort of force him into a more traditional campaign infrastructure, at least, if not campaign positioning, ideology, and rhetoric? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that these wealthy donors are not going to give up entirely if they're unsuccessful in anointing, helping their preferred candidate win the Republican nomination.
Interestingly, the Koch brothers said they were willing to spend almost $1 billion this election season. Sheldon Adelson spent, I think, $100 million 4 years ago. And again, they seem to be standing on the sidelines. I'm not sure whether they're just being agnostic this season or whether they're waiting for Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz to make it to the top of the Republican pile.
Yeah, well, I think there are two distinct examples there. The Koch brothers are really unique. I think they almost stand alone among mega donors on either side in that they have essentially created their own private political machine that in some ways rivals that the infrastructure of the RNC, both in terms of the amount of money that they're able to raise. Of course, they have a huge advantage over the party committees or the candidates in that they are not beholden to these contribution limits that the parties and the candidates must adhere to. But then also their ideology is distinct from the Republican Party in that they are sort of a more libertarian and they have non-interventionist foreign policy positions. And so they have sought to protect this branding that they have established for themselves as sort of an ideology-driven non-partisan, but sort of above partisan politics entity. And so they have been wary of wading into Republican primaries, period, whether it's at the presidential level or down ballot. And they had had a rather vigorous debate about whether Donald Trump was just so anathema to the sort of fiscal conservatism that animates their political giving that they would make an exception and would go in and spend a lot of money to try to keep him from winning the Republican nomination. Ultimately, they decided against that and are now, according to my sources, extremely unlikely to wade into the primary. Hmm. Of course, this is a huge advantage for Donald Trump. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the Kochs wouldn't have an impact in the 2016 election overall. They could either focus their spending on Senate races or House races or even in state legislatures and state governors races where they have been hugely impactful. Or they could try to push Donald Trump to the right on some of these fiscal issues where, again, he has not been at all aligned with the Republican orthodoxy, talking about, spending huge sums of money to build the wall way between Mexico, although he says that he would have Mexico pay for it, which I think is sort of a dubious claim, and talking about sort of aggressive foreign intervention in some ways that runs against the sort of neoconservative strain of the Republican Party. So there are a number of ways in which which these big donors who have really key issues that sort of drive their political giving feel distrustful of Donald Trump. And he has used that to his advantage. I mean, part of his campaign messaging is that he is independent from these donors. And he likes to highlight and sort of name check these donors when they end up picking between some of his rivals. And so I do think that you see some of the donors who are a little bit leery about going in against him because they're concerned that they will sort of incur his wrath.
Well, let me pick up on that, because you had a really interesting piece in Politico about some of these big donors who are opposed to Donald Trump, but are either afraid to or unwilling to invest in any kind of campaign to try to take him down. I'm thinking people were not afraid of John Kerry and took him down. What are they afraid of, do you think?
Well, I mean, again, he has shown a willingness to go after these folks who otherwise have not been, while they have been hugely influential in the political process, they, for the most part, except with the exception of a few folks like the Koch brothers who have become kind of household names, they, for the most part, haven't seen themselves become part of the debate. And he's shown a willingness to make them part of the debate. A woman by the name of Marlene Ricketts, who is the wife of the TD Ameritrade founder Joe Ricketts, gave $3 million to a super PAC that was set up, one of the few super PACs that was set up exclusively to sort of bring Donald Trump down that has actually raised any money. And she is the biggest donor. And when her contribution was revealed over the weekend, when the Federal Election Commission reports were published for January, Donald Trump seized on the news that she had given this money and tweeted that she, quote, better be careful. They have a lot to hide, that they being the Ricketts family. So that's sort of a level of, engagement and confrontation that some of these mega donors, who many of whom have very active business interests that depend to some degree on having a good relationship with the public or with other firms that do business in their sectors, you know, they're leery of being drawn into the political debate like that.
Well, and we're talking about millionaires and billionaires who are afraid of someone saying something bad about them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain irony there. There's also a certain irony that these people are willing to spend all this money in the process and want to influence it, but don't want to have their names mentioned. And so, of course, we do see avenues for anonymous political giving, and that is part of the discussion right now. There are, thanks to Citizens United, there are nonprofit groups registered under a section of the IRS code that allows them to spend money in politics without disclosing the names of their donors. I think if there is an effort to go after Trump by these very wealthy donors, it would more likely be through means like that, partly because of this thing that I talked about, this dynamic where these donors are afraid of getting a tweet from Donald Trump that calls them out. But it's interesting just to look at the numbers. There's been $238 million spent by super PACs in the presidential race thus far. Only 4% of that, $9.5 million, has been spent targeting Donald Trump. So it is one of the great mysteries, along with the mystery of why Donald Trump's rival candidates themselves did not more aggressively go after Donald Trump while he was sort of less unstoppable than he is seen right now. He's gotten a little bit of a free pass from some of these groups that approach some of these groups and candidates that approach politics in a more traditional way and use more traditional analyses and calculations to determine, like, who is their threat and what is the best use of their money and how should they be messaging. Donald Trump, again, has turned all that on its head, along with this idea that big money can really shape the primary processes of both parties.
And we're almost out of time here, Ken. Where does that leave the Republican Party itself in about 10 seconds or less, if you don't mind?
It leaves them almost out of time, Marty. They are basically coming to grips with this idea that everything that they've tried hasn't worked to stop Donald Trump. And they are sort of imagining and coming to grips with the prospect of Donald Trump being their Republican nominee.
Well, to be continued. Ken Vogel, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Hey, it was a pleasure.
And he tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico, the first of three guests in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We began talking about money. We'll be talking about superdelegates after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. If you've been following the race between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Bernie Sanders for the Democratic presidential nomination, you've heard talk about not just delegates, but superdelegates. And to date, many of them have said that they support Hillary Clinton. We asked Stephen Medvick to join us. He's the Honorable and Mrs. John C. Kunkel Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania, author of a book called In Defense of Politicians, The Expectations, Trap and Its Threat to Democracy. And Stephen Medvick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be back with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions that you might have about delegates, superdelegates, and the Pennsylvania primary, which comes up at the very end or near the very end of April. Stephen, let's start with superdelegates. And
sure.
where did this come from?
So the notion of a superdelegate comes from the early 1980s. But to understand it, you really have to kind of go back to the 1968 nomination battle on the Democratic side.
Yes
exactly. And so what happened in 1968, of course, is that the party nominated a candidate that much of the rank and file of the Democratic Party didn't support. And so there was a very nasty and bitter battle at the National Convention. And in the wake of that, the party put together a commission, the McGovern-Fraser Commission, that said, how are we going to reform this process to open it up, to make it more democratic so that it's not controlled by the party bosses? And what they said was, essentially, any delegate that goes to the National Convention has to have been selected through a process of either a primary or a caucus. The voters have to choose who the delegates will be going to the National Convention. And so that's what the party put in place. The Republican Party kind of followed suit, because state laws govern primaries. And so the process was really opened up. And what happened on the Democratic side was that in 1972, the party nominated George McGovern. And then in 76, another outsider, really, Jimmy Carter, who won the presidency but was not the choice of the party establishment. And then in 1980, that same Jimmy Carter, the president now, who did have the support of the establishment in 1980, was challenged by Ted Kennedy.
Right.
And another bitter battle at the convention over rules and platform changes. And so in 1981, 1982, the Hunt Commission was put together in the Democratic Party, and they said, how are we going to give the establishment, the party insiders, a little more say, at least some say, in this process? And they said, well, we'll create these superdelegates, who are technically the term for superdelegates is party leaders and elected official delegates, so PLEO. And these PLEO or superdelegates are not pledged to any candidate based on votes in their state. Many of them commit to a candidate, they support a candidate, but they're not selected based on the votes of people in primaries or caucuses. And so there are 712 of them this year. They're made up of elected officials in Congress and governors. They're all of the members of the Democratic National Committee are superdelegates. And then there's a handful of what are called distinguished party leaders. These are the sitting president and vice president, or past presidents and vice presidents, or party chairs. Ed Rendell, for example, is a distinguished party leader this year. And so in total, like I said, there's 712 of these, which makes up about 15% of all the delegates to the Democratic National Convention.
And what I think brought this to the fore was after the New Hampshire primary, when Bernie Sanders really trounced Hillary Clinton, it became apparent that there were the delegates that were distributed among the two candidates. But what you saw were the number of superdelegates, at least so far, who have voiced their support for Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. So out of that 712 superdelegates, at last count, about 451 were supporting Clinton, and only 19 supporting Sanders. And so the Sanders people got concerned because they said, well, look, in terms of the delegates who are pledged, you know, who are being chosen based on votes in these primaries or caucuses, right now it's sort of neck and neck. But when you add in the superdelegates, Clinton's way ahead. And so the concern among Sanders supporters is, well, the superdelegates could end up throwing this thing toward Clinton, even if the voters in all these states have said that they support or would like to see Sanders nominated.
Do you anticipate, as in previous conventions, and this one for the Democrats will be in Philadelphia this summer, but do you anticipate at this point, where are we almost the end, or near the end of February, that there could be some kind of convention battle over delegates and superdelegates?
I mean, there could in theory, but in practice, the superdelegates have never really made much of an impact. They may have in 1984, the very first time they were in place. They maybe helped Mondale get a little bit over the hump, although Mondale was leading in the polls and he won lots of primaries, but there was no real majority going into the convention, and the superdelegates put him over. But even in 08, where the initially the Obama people were concerned about the superdelegates, things worked themselves out. The superdelegates actually split down the middle the same way the voters did, and the superdelegates were not really a factor in 08 either. So I don't think the superdelegates would be the cause of a convention battle. And the odds are that Hillary Clinton will probably move far enough ahead of Sanders in the pledge delegate count that, again, the superdelegates probably won't be a factor.
But was the thinking going back a couple of decades that the Democratic Party didn't want, what, quote-unquote, outsiders hijacking their nomination process?
Yeah, they may not have put it quite that way, but that really, that's a great question. Because so what is the purpose of the superdelegate? And I think the idea, again, in theory, is that if one of two things happens. If the candidates go into the convention and the voters have not been clear about who they want, so that no one has a majority, or that they're, you know, maybe that split three ways or something, there's going to have to be a nominee, and the party insiders could determine that nominee at the convention if the voters haven't already made up their minds. Or the other possibility is something like what's happening in the Republican Party, right? Where if the insiders were solidly against somebody, but the voters were overwhelmingly for them, and the insiders thought that is a real disaster for our party, they might then be able to, you know, be able to overturn the will of the voters. But mm-hmm. in that situation, I still think it's unlikely the superdelegates would do that, because imagine what kind of damage that would do to the party. I mean, if the rank and file, the base of the party, said this is who we want, but the superdelegates said no, I mean, that would be really irreparable harm done to the party. So I doubt even in that circumstance they would do what theoretically they are designed to do.
Well, let's go back to sixth grade, our civics lesson here, because as you mentioned, Stephen, that when we vote for delegates, and it's the delegates who choose the president, for instance. And I think for a lot of people, they either don't know that or perhaps have forgotten that.
Right. So when they're going to the polls in a primary or they're going to caucus, they're pledging their support for a candidate.
Right.
But ultimately, the process is to select people who will go to the convention and cast votes on behalf of the voters for a candidate. And as I said, since 1972, that's been pretty closely tied to the delegates. That is, have been pretty closely tied to the voters and the candidates that the voters want to have support going into the convention. But it's really the delegates who are going to make that decision at the convention. Although, again, most of them are pledged.
Right.
So when they come out of a state, if half of them are pledged to Hillary and half to Bernie, on the first ballot at the convention, that's how they're supposed to vote. That's how they do vote. And so at least the first vote at the convention is kind of a known quantity. I mean, we know that most of the delegates are going to be pledged, except for the superdelegates.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Medvick, and he's a professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania. We are talking about delegates, superdelegates, and this is an issue that's come up, especially on the Republican side, with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton running for the Democratic nomination for president. And again, any questions or comments, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A bit of a civics lesson in this hour of ballot talks on Radio Times. Stephen, even going back to the couple of primaries and caucuses that we've had so far, I mean, some of them are winner take all. Some of them are apportioned by how much a person wins. Is that really something that's done state by state?
It is absolutely done state by state, and every. It seems that every state is different. One important way states are different is whether they have an open or a closed process, an open primary or a closed primary. Of course, in Pennsylvania, we have a closed primary, which means that only registered Democrats can vote in the Democratic primary, only registered Republicans in the Republican primary, and independents or third party, people who are registered with a third party, cannot vote in either party's primary. That's the minority. There are only about 11 states that have closed primaries that way. And so most states have some level of openness in their primary so that maybe independents could vote in either party's primary, or in some places like New Hampshire, even the other party can choose to vote in the opposite party's primary.
Wow.
And so part of the reason for superdelegates is to say, well, it's not always even actual Democrats voting in the Democratic primaries. A lot of times it's independents, and they may not always have the long-term best interests of the party in mind, whereas clearly the superdelegates do. And so that's another rationale for having superdelegates.
Well, let me read a tweet here. 16% of Democratic delegates are superdelegates and therefore outside the Democratic process. The definition of establishment from our online person here, basically saying, look, if these people are already committed, they're not really voting, they're really outside the Democratic process. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, they're they're elected officials primarily. Most of them are elected officials. Even the members of the Democratic National Committee are chosen through a process in the states. And so they are accountable to voters eventually in some way, maybe indirectly in this process. But I don't know that they're completely outside the Democratic process. What the assumption behind that tweet is that, you know, this process of selecting a nominee for a party ought to be as democratic as possible. It ought to be as democratic as a general election. And some people would argue, well, because this is party business, really, the parties are figuring out who the best nominee for their party is. Maybe it doesn't have to be quite as democratic. Now, that's, you know, not a popular thing to say in this day and age, but that's the thinking behind the superdelegates, is that, well, you know, look, they are the ones who are most committed to the well-being of the party, and they ought to have some say at least, right? They ought to have some role to play. And if they're not democratically chosen through the primary process, well, so be it. But this is party business that we're really attending to through this entire nomination process.
But what's so interesting is that there's so much less party loyalty these days. And I think maybe that's what, the critics say, which is that I don't necessarily feel a loyalty to one party over another. I like this candidate. I like that candidate.
Right. And then the party establishment, which is now a dirty word, but let's say the party, the formal party organization, let's call it that, would say, well, then why do you think you should have a say in what our party is deciding to do in terms of who they nominate? I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but, you know, that would be the argument, is that, again, this is party business. We're deciding who we want to put forward as our standard bearer, and somebody who's kind of fickle or decides today they're a Democrat but next year a Republican shouldn't really be allowed to have much influence in that process. You know, the other side is represented by what that person who tweeted says, which is, let's open all of this up, make it as democratic as possible, because ultimately the two people nominated have a 50-50 chance of becoming the next president, and so we should have a say at every step of the process.
Well, speaking of having a say, the Pennsylvania primary is April 26, and we're not at Super Tuesday quite yet, but there are obviously a couple of primaries and caucuses before then. Mm-hmm. Do you think, as it stands now, that puts Pennsylvania sort of out of the decision-making?
It typically does. I mean, we normally see that when you get to about 65% of the delegates allocated, the process is pretty much winding down at that point. The Democrats get to that point just before April 26th, which is the Pennsylvania primary. Right after the New York primary on April 19th, there'll be 65% of their delegates will have been chosen. On the Republican side, it's even more. It's 72%, 73% will have been chosen by the time Pennsylvania rolls around. So normally we would guess that in both parties we're going to know who the inevitable nominee is. I think that's probably going to be true on the Democratic side. It might not be on the Republican side, though. So on the Republican side of things, Pennsylvania could be a pretty important player this year.
Obviously, a reference to Trump holding the lead and the party elders or the party elite sort of tearing their hair out trying to figure out what to do with this candidate.
You're right. And this is what's so fascinating about what's happening there. And it's the exact opposite of what we were just talking about with superdelegates, because on the Republican side, they don't really have superdelegates. Sometimes people refer to superdelegates in the Republican Party. But what that means is there are three delegates from every state and every territory who are party leaders who get to go to the convention. These are the Republican National Committee man and committee woman and the state party chair. The difference is those people, by party rules in the Republican Party, are pledged to whoever won their state. So they're not free agents to make up their own mind. They go to the convention on behalf of whoever won their state's primary or caucus. So they're left with, like I said, the opposite of the Democratic Party, no opportunity for the party establishment to have much influence outside of kind of informal or indirect ways like endorsements and things like that. But what's happening in the party now is that outsiders, grassroots, the base, whatever you want to call it, are really dictating what's going to happen in that party, and it seems to be completely contrary to what the party organization, the party establishment would like.
Is there effort, or has there been effort in the past, to move the Pennsylvania primary up. I mean, everyone wants to kind of front load this thing to have some kind of influence. Is that a live issue here in Pennsylvania?
It's talked about every so often, and it ends up not going anywhere. And part of it is because the parties are trying to encourage states not to front load. And you know, the idea is that, well, maybe the rest of the offices on the ballot during the primary. So we have, you know, on the Democratic side, at least, a contested Senate primary.
Right.
And then there may be some contested primaries for the House or for other offices. Those may be able to get more attention if we hold off and make it and put it a little later in the calendar. So there's been some talk about it, but there doesn't seem to be a ton of interest in doing anything to move it forward.
And is Pennsylvania still considered a swing state when it comes to presidential elections?
That's a great question. I think it's sometimes considered one, but whether it really is one is another question. People talk about it as if it is one, but Pennsylvania has been solidly Democratic for the last several election cycles, and it seems as though it's not really a swing state any longer. But that can change. I mean, individual candidates can have an appeal in a state that other candidates in that party wouldn't have had. I mean, so if you think back to 2008, Obama was able to win Indiana, a state where Democrats would never think they could be competitive and usually aren't. This year, some people are saying that if Trump's the nominee on the Republican side, he might appeal to white working class voters in the state in a way that could put it in play. I'm not so sure about that, but people think that maybe the right nominee in the Republican Party could appeal to some what we used to call Reagan Democrats and make the state competitive again.
Well, what an interesting election year. Stephen Medvick, thank you so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the Honorable and Mrs. John C. Kunkel Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College. Wrote a book called In Defense of Politicians, The Expectations Trap and Its Threat to Democracy. The second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We began talking about money in politics. We were just talking about delegates and superdelegates, and coming up, we'll be talking about endorsements. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen. You're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times here on WHYY. 538 has been tracking endorsements for the presidential candidates and found that Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton have gotten the most from governors, senators, and representatives so far. Now we want to take a look at the value and power of endorsements for candidates, whether from their political colleagues, from newspapers, from celebrities, and the effect of anti-endorsements, meaning don't vote for this person. We asked Jordan Ragusa to join us, assistant professor of political science at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. And Jordan, nice to have you with us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Going back to last weekend, Marco Rubio was endorsed by your governor, Nikki Haley, your senator, Tim Scott. Was that helpful to him, even if he didn't win?
Yes. I think that there's really no question that Nikki Haley's endorsement in particular was sort of pivotal for why Marco Rubio finished in second place. You know, I've looked at some of the data on endorsements and how much they matter, and the data suggests that, you know, overall endorsements do matter, but you can look more specifically at what happened before Haley's endorsement and how Rubio was expected to perform and how he ultimately performed after receiving her endorsement. You know, most of the polls had Rubio at about 18% prior to her endorsement. After her endorsement, he finished with 22.5% of the vote. Most of the data that I've looked at suggests that endorsements from a governor matter about 4%, and it seems that, like in this case, it did matter about 4%. So I think that clearly for Rubio, those endorsements helped vault him into second place, where maybe without them, he would have finished in third.
Does that also tell us about the popularity of your governor, Nikki Haley, that she, by endorsing Rubio, was able to persuade people because people apparently like her in South Carolina?
Yes. I mean, I think it does matter, you know, how popular the person is that's doing the endorsing. And, you know, in South Carolina, Nikki Haley is a very popular governor. You know, some polls that I've seen suggest that she has the support of over 80% of voters in South Carolina.
Wow.
And she gets a lot of credit for how she handled the Charleston shooting. And so even among some Democrats and independents, she's viewed very favorably. So I think, yeah, it does matter how popular she is.
I wonder, even more broadly speaking, about political endorsements. I began by talking about 538. I looked at their site this morning, tracking various endorsements. And again, Marco Rubio, Hillary Clinton, getting most of them from people like governors and senators and representatives. Do you think in this sort of topsy-turvy election season that those kinds of endorsements have the same kind of power and punch that they had in previous elections?
I think that they do. You know, it's difficult to say whether or not the effect of endorsements has sort of changed over time. I think it does make sense that they are probably less salient today than they were maybe 50 years ago. You know, one thing that we know is that party identification is just a much stronger predictor of voting behavior today. So that means that endorsements can have less of an effect. You know, it's also the case that voters today are just inundated with information about the candidates, and so they may be less reliant on an endorsement when making their decision. So I think it's possible that things have changed a little bit to mute the power of endorsements. And certainly Donald Trump has not received a lot of endorsements from the Republican establishment, and he seems to be doing pretty well. But I would still not discount the fact that endorsements do matter, even today, at least at the margins.
Let me talk a bit about New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton, if not endorsed, certainly had a lot of the political people standing behind her. And as we know, Bernie Sanders beat her by like something like 20 points. So she was the sort of favored candidate of the establishment. But Bernie Sanders walked away with the victory. What do you think that tells us?
Well, I mean, one thing that you have to keep in mind is that when political scientists say that endorsements matter, what they really mean is that there is a significant effect of endorsements among a variety of other factors. And so, you know, when you have a fairly liberal state like New Hampshire, you know, it's not particularly surprising that despite having received a lot of endorsements, you know, a more moderate candidate like Hillary Clinton would lose out to the more liberal candidate like Bernie Sanders. You know, so endorsements do matter. They have an effect, but they're not everything, and they may not matter in every single race.
Going also back to New Hampshire, the union leader had endorsed Chris Christie among the Republican candidates, and of course he dropped out after New Hampshire. What do you think about newspaper endorsements? And in the olden days, it seems like they mattered quite a bit. How about today?
Yeah, I think probably the evidence is that newspaper endorsements matter slightly less today than in the past. You know, one of the reasons why we think that endorsements matter is that they fill sort of an informational gap that a lot of voters have. You know, especially in a primary election, voters may not know a lot about the candidates. And so if they read in their newspaper that that they're endorsing a particular candidate, that would certainly have an effect. But with the amount of information that voters are exposed to today and given the decline of newspapers, I think it stands to reason that newspapers would have less of an effect today than maybe 50 years ago.
Could we say that so-called low-information voters are more reliant on endorsements, whether they're coming from other candidates or whether other elected officials or newspapers or even celebrities?
Yes. Yeah, I think there's really no question about it. I mean, voters try to make an informed decision. Most of them want to make the most informed decision possible, but you know, people are pretty busy in their daily lives. You know, they have jobs, they have kids, you know, they want to maintain a social relationship with friends and colleagues. And so, you know, spending the time to sit down and figure out where the candidates stand on a variety of issues and thinking about them and making a really informed decision can be pretty costly. So, you know, what people do in those situations is they rely on endorsements to fill that gap. So the less you pay attention to politics, you know, the less you're watching the news, you know, the less you know about the candidates beforehand, which is what we would describe as a low information voter, then those endorsements can be even more powerful. If you're watching the news all the time, if you know everything about the candidates beforehand, a new endorsement is less likely to sway your vote.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jordan Ragusa. He's assistant professor of political science at the College of Charleston. That would be in Charleston, South Carolina, the third of three guests in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And we are looking at the power or perhaps the losing status of things like endorsements. And we're curious about whether that would matter to you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You mentioned Donald Trump, and of course, he's sort of breaking all the rules of running for president and pretty much an endorsement-free campaign so far. He did, though, bring in Sarah Palin. You're down there in South Carolina, and I know Sarah Palin and Nikki Haley were buds to some degree. How do you think her endorsement of Trump played, or did that not matter with his followers?
You know, I think it maybe goes back a little bit to what we talked about with respect to the endorsee's popularity. You know, Nikki Haley is incredibly popular in South Carolina. I haven't seen any polling data on how popular Sarah Palin is down here, but I would feel fairly safe saying that Palin is probably less popular than Nikki Haley. So I think that probably Palin's endorsement did matter, but with that kind of an endorsement, I think it's probably at the margins. One of the really interesting things that I found in some data that my students collected on Election Day is that there was a very interesting pattern between when people decided that they were going to support a candidate and who they ultimately voted for. And what the data showed was that most of Trump's supporters actually made their mind up months ago or the moment that he decided that he was going to run in the Republican primary. What that suggests to me is that, endorsements are probably less important for Trump supporters because they've known all along. On the other side, Marco Rubio voters said that they decided sometimes the day of the election, and many of them in the few days before the election after Haley's endorsement. So for someone like Rubio, I think the endorsements do matter much more than for someone like Trump.
What about things like anti-endorsements? Bob Dole recently went out and said to people, don't vote for Ted Cruz. And there have been some other anti-endorsements. Is there something new about that?
I don't think that there's anything new about it. I'm sure if we systematically recorded data on anti-endorsements, I bet that we would see that they're actually pretty common throughout throughout U.S. history. Whether or not anti-endorsements have the same kind of effect of endorsements, I don't believe that anyone's looked at that. You know, I suspect that they probably do matter, but probably less so than the actual endorsements.
We have, of course, a Super Tuesday coming up. I believe Ted Cruz got an endorsement from the governor of Texas, Governor Greg Abbott. And I guess this is sort of looking ahead in the next couple of days and looking into your crystal ball with Ted Cruz kind of neck and neck with Marco Rubio. Of course, Texas is the state that he represents. Do you anticipate that might be helpful to Senator Cruz?
I think it certainly would help him. You know, some of the polling that I've looked at actually shows, a pretty tight race, even in Texas, between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. So I think at this stage, you know, Cruz would be happy to have any endorsement that he could get. You know, but Cruz has more of a fundamental problem going forward other than the endorsements. You know, his sort of firewall was always thought to be, you know, the Super Tuesday states, in particular the southeastern Super Tuesday states, where there's a lot of evangelicals that should be friendly to him. Unfortunately, a lot of the Super Tuesday states are awarding their delegates on a proportional basis, which would sort of mute the number of delegates that he ultimately gets. Many of the mid-March states, which end up being more favorable for Marco Rubio, award their delegates on a winner-take-all basis. So Ted Cruz certainly wants to win Texas. It would be kind of a bad sign if he lost. He'll take the endorsements. But I think that Ted Cruz has more systematic challenges that he's facing going forward.
We'll talk about celebrity endorsements. I saw that Phil Robertson, he's the Duck Dynasty guy. He endorsed Ted Cruz, and there are other celebrities that have weighed in on various candidates. Do you think that has an impact on voters?
I think it does. There has been some research on the effect of celebrity endorsements, and if I'm recalling it correctly, I think that, you know, they have very minimal effect. You know, again, it's one of those things where, you know, maybe it matters, but it's really sort of at the margins.
Right.
And I suspect that there are a couple reasons for that. You know, one is that, you know, people who pay attention to celebrities tend to be younger on average, and because they're younger on average, they're probably less likely to vote. So maybe it's changing some minds, but those people don't ultimately show up on election day. I also think it's the case that probably with celebrities, you know, their endorsement of a product would maybe have a significant effect on your behavior. But I don't think that we really look to celebrities systematically for political information.
We don't, but sometimes that association can help some voters. I'm thinking Bernie Sanders kind of hanging out with Vampire Weekend. Morgan Freeman, I believe, is voicing a commercial for Hillary Clinton. So clearly celebrities or musicians, in the case of Vampire Weekend, are saying to their followers, this is the person that I support.
Right. I think one of the, you know, the one that comes to mind for me is 2008. So in 2008, Oprah made a lot of headlines by endorsing Obama for president. And, you know, I think that some political scientists did an analysis, and the evidence suggested that her endorsement netted Obama about 1 million additional votes beyond
wow.
what he would have received without her endorsement. You know, so I think they can matter. Obviously, Oprah has a pretty lofty position, and I think that it would be hard for other celebrities to match her effect. So they can matter. I'm simply saying that I think they matter slightly less than political endorsements from establishment party officials and candidates.
I've even seen, I'm sure you have as well, Jordan, selfie endorsements, you know, somebody taking a picture with a candidate and then out it goes. I mean, this is the world we live in, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, in terms of selfie endorsements, it'd be pretty hard to quantify their effect. I mean, I'm trying to think about how you would design a study to examine something like that. Maybe they matter. It may be at the margins, like some kinds of endorsements. But certainly candidates, you know, love free media. They love, you know, the free nature of social media. So, you know, a good selfie or some sort of viral video that's retweeted or re-liked all over Facebook is certainly valuable. But in terms of the effect of an individual selfie, I think it's probably minuscule.
Is this an interesting time to be an assistant professor of political science?
I always tell people that it's always an interesting time to be an assistant professor of political science. I mean, my students are certainly very interested in the campaign. They're interested in what's going on in politics. You know, sometimes they're more interested than others, but, you know, there's always interesting and important things to talk about in class.
But do you think this is a particularly unusual campaign so far?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there's really no question about it. I mean, Donald Trump on his own is, you know, one of the most interesting political storylines that we have had in a decade, you know, to say nothing of the fight between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. You know, the fact that we're likely to see, you know, a female on the Democratic ticket. You know, we have a Democratic Socialist candidate in second place that's, you know, fairly close to
sure.
receiving the nomination. You know, it's there's no question that this is interesting and an important time for a lot of different reasons.
Well, Jordan Ragusa, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, he's assistant professor of political science at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina, the third of three guests in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking about money in politics, talking about superdelegates, and also talking about endorsements. We hope you appreciate these kinds of programs. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tell us what you think. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.